This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, astronaut Don Pettit, who shot the millionth photo from the International Space Station, joins us to talk about the joy of photography from 200 miles above the Earth. But first, the 21st Century Cures Act has passed the House and now the Senate with broad bipartisan support. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky spoke at an emotional procedural vote this week with Vice President Joe Biden presiding.
I think it's fitting to dedicate this bill's critical cancer initiatives in honor of someone who'd be proud of the presiding officer today, and that's his son, Beau. And in just a moment, that's exactly what the Senate will do. Renaming the NIH's cancer initiatives in this bill after Beau Biden.
Joe Biden's son, Beau, died last year of a brain tumor, and the dedication made for a really an emotional day in the Senate, with at least one senator wiping his eyes. The bill will now head to President Obama's desk, where he's pledged to sign it. And it is an enormous bill, which, other than the cancer moonshot, also addresses the growing opioid epidemic, mental health research, and genetic medicine. And here's a big one. It could change how the FDA regulates drugs and devices by speeding up that process. Is that such a good thing? Here to answer those questions, unpack the act, are my guests. Cindy Lupkin is a correspondent at Kaiser Health News in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. John LaMattina is the former head of Pfizer R&D, and he writes about the pharmaceutical industry at Forbes. He's here in our New York studios, so welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Our number, if you'd like to talk about, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Sydney, you've written that this is one of the most lobbied health care bills in recent history.
Yeah. Basically, there are more than 1,400 registered lobbyists on this bill, representing more than 400 different organizations, from pharmaceutical companies and device companies to universities and hospitals, patient groups focused on specific diseases, and then advocacy groups as well.
And you wrote it at Kaiser Health News that pharmaceutical and medical device companies are one of the big winners of this bill. Why is that?
Basically, the bill makes the approval process a bit more flexible. For instance, the secondary use approvals for already approved drugs. So if there's a drug that's already been approved and you want to get an additional use approved for it, it allows something called real world evidence, which is anecdotal evidence, research from observational trials, insurance claims data, things that are different from the traditional phase 1, 2, and 3 clinical trials, which are very expensive. So this could stand to save the pharmaceutical companies and device companies money. Critics say that this also opens the door to unsafe approvals.
Mm-hmm. John, you're a veteran of the drug industry. Your reaction to this leeway the FDA will have?
What's worrisome to me is a little bit different from Sydney's, but not totally. Let me use an example from last week. There's a growing need, cry for new drugs to treat Alzheimer's disease. And just last week, Lilly reported results of a compound that they had high hopes for named solanezumab, and unfortunately, the drug didn't work. If more lenient rules were put into play, the FDA, and there are those who believe the FDA has far too much bureaucracy, that drug might have been approved a few years ago based on early clinical trials, which were very favorable, early safety studies in people that were very favorable, and some trends toward impressive efficacy. Had the FDA said, well, go ahead and start marketing this and just keep your long-term trials ongoing to make sure that it reverses the disease, this drug might have been taken by 1 million people for 3 years. And if Lilly priced the drug at, say, $20 a day, you would have had, they would have amassed $7 billion a year in revenues, which after 3 years would have been in tens of millions of dollars. Now, picture being on a drug for 3 years and having the studies, long-term studies, come back and say, well, never mind, doesn't work, it's like a placebo. Patients would be upset that they've been on something. payers would be upset that they were paying for something that's ineffective. And I would argue it would blow back on Lilly because people would be upset. That's you've made all these billions of dollars and there's nothing to show for you, essentially given a glorified placebo. So I think it doesn't work for everybody in the healthcare system.
Wow. Sydney, let's talk about NIH funding. In the bill, they get nearly $5 billion in additional funding under the Act, right? Sounds like a good thing.
So it does sound like a good thing. That's one of the reasons that hospitals and universities seem to be lobbying in favor of this bill, even as some of them had doctors on their payroll, writing in medical journals that actually the FDA changes in this bill could open the door to these unsafe approvals. The NIH funding will go toward Vice President Joe Biden's cancer moonshot, toward precision medicine, which is genetics research, and the brain initiative, which is brain research.
Hmm. Is this for sure, or do they have to constantly reauthorize this money every year?
So this is authorized. What they have to do is they have to appropriate it every year. But basically, that's just words. Every year it has to be approved in appropriations bill.
Mm-hmm. John, one of the big components of the act is the cancer moonshot that President Obama said he was going to give to Joe Biden. Immunotherapy drugs are really revolutionizing cancer therapy, but also come with some big risks. Is that the sort of the high-risk, high-reward drugs that you're fearful of?
Well, so that's a wonderful example. No, I'm not fearful of that, but it shows the important role of the FDA. These drugs have revolutionized cancer treatments. There have been people who have been told to make their final plans because there was nothing left to treat them, and these drugs came on the scene and actually saved lives. But they do come with a risk. They upregulate your immune system, and sometimes if your immune system is too upregulated, it gets out of whack. And so what the FDA does and what its most important role is to balance safety and risk. And a lot of times they will approve a drug that will save a person's life from cancer, even though you may have a greater tendency to diabetes. And let's face it, if you ask somebody, do you want to die of cancer in the next year or you want to run the risk of having diabetes, of course they will pick the cancer drug. But you need to have a regulatory body like the FDA to rule on these sort of things.
So you need to have a person in the FDA who's the head of the FDA who's thinking about these
absolutely.
Issues.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Sydney, what's your reaction?
I think that coming from sort of actually before I was at Kaiser, I was at a website that wrote about studies for doctors. So I think that, yes, the FDA's role is to look at the best evidence and weigh risk and benefit. Oftentimes on labels, it says, this drug is only to be administered for this patient in this disease group after a first therapy has been tried or after surgery.
Mm-hmm. One of the most discussed topics in medicine in the last year or two is the price of drugs. Does this bill do anything to alleviate this rising cost of drugs?
No, it doesn't. That was one of the things that several different groups had written before it passed the House and said, this is going to be a lot of things that the pharmaceutical companies like. It's going to save them money. But where are the price controls? Now, in theory, if you're saving pharmaceutical companies money, maybe they'll pass those savings on to the patients. However, there are studies that have shown that typically, drugs are not priced based off the R&D. They're priced based off of something called what the market will bear, basically how much are patients willing to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. And John, any prediction on what this bill might mean for healthcare costs?
Oh, I don't think it will have anything to do really with healthcare costs. I think that healthcare costs, you can have multiple shows, Ira, on this topic because there are so many different things involved here. But I will differ with Sydney a little bit in that I prefer to think of drugs being priced based on the value they bring to the healthcare system. And maybe that's the price that you can translate that or use a euphemism to say the price that the market will bear. But you have to really prove the value of your drug, even in the United States or certainly around the rest of the world, and negotiate pricing there based on the savings and the life or death type of medicine that you're bringing forward.
Mm-hmm. President-elect Trump said that he tweeted out yesterday, the day before, and a few days ago, drove this price of pharmaceutical the stock market way down because he says, I'm going to bring down the cost of drugs too.
Well, there are a lot of things he could do to help that. So, the big issue that came up with Martin Shkreli, the infamous hedge fund manager who took this drug, Daraprim, and raised the price from $10 to $750, that's a generic drug. anybody can make that drug. The problem was it made so little money that no generic companies were out there making it. Turns out there's a backlog at the FDA for generic drug approvals that are about 4 years right now. Trump can come in, and those, you know, all of those approvals will lead to competition and much, much cheaper drugs. All Trump has to do is authorize the FDA to hire more people and get this backlog down in a year or two, and you'd see a lot of the prices of these drugs, which should be very cheap, come way down.
What do you mean hire more people? There are openings that need to be filled?
Well, I think they need more people to go through this backlog. Absolutely.
Sydney, you agree?
So there are actually a lot of openings that the FDA has been operating with. So I think there are actually fewer in the generic area than in the new drug area, but I want to double check on that. In CDER, the part of the FDA that approves new drugs, they've been struggling with a 700 employee backlog. So just to sort of back up regarding generics, there in 2012, to sort of start to address this backlog, they initiated something called the Generic Drug User Fee Amendment. GDUFA is the acronym. And what that did was that charged fees for the application to bring on new employees. And actually, in the last, 4 years since 2012, they brought on an additional 1,000 employees. But, and I've also written for this on KHN.org, although they are approving more generic drugs than they have in the past, they still have a very long median approval time of, I think, 47 months.
That's 4 years.
I've heard higher numbers, but perhaps Sydney is closer to it, knows more. But I've heard the number of generic drugs out there are in the hundreds waiting to be approved.
Wow. So is the consumer, in the last seconds I have, going to benefit from this bill, do you think, John?
What I love about the bill are the additional money to the NIH. $5 billion is a lot of money. They can use 5 times that amount, 10 times that amount. And some of the other things, the cancer moonshot, it's hard to argue with any of that. It's great stuff.
Sydney, good, bad, and unbalanced.
I think it basically remains to be seen. There are things that if the money is appropriated every year, that's great. If the FDA is able to sort of weigh the risks and benefits and use any discretion that it has, that's also great. But it really remains to be seen.
Sydney Lupkin, correspondent at Kaiser Health News in Washington. John LaMattina, who writes about the pharmaceutical industry at Forbes. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back after the short break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. There's a lot you might not know about astronaut Don Pettit. He plays the didgeridoo. He writes poetry about his experience while in orbit. And he's yearning to return. And he's taken hundreds of thousands of photos from the International Space Station, many mundane, others stunning works of art. Black and white, infrared, wide-angle views of the Earth, blurred star trails above the Earth, and more. He also took the 1,000,000th photo from the International Space Station way back in 2012. He's compiled some of his favorites in a new book, Spaceborne. And you can see some of these photos on our website, plus an article about the technique behind them, sciencefriday.com/spacephotos. And here to talk about it is Don Pettit. He's a NASA astronaut based at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. He's flown 3 missions to the International Space Station. He's lived there a total of 370 days. Good to have you back again, Don.
It's always a pleasure, Ira.
Tell us about your photography hobby. Were you interested in photography before you went into space?
I started taking pictures when I was around in the sixth grade with a Kodak Brownie camera. I think it used 127 roll film, and I spent all my allowance money on black and white film and developed it in my mother's darkroom that she had set up.
Yeah, I had that camera too, I think, a few of us. From the article on our website by Chow Tu, the one I was referring to, I want to quote from you. You say, "The making of art is, I believe, an inevitable consequence of being human, and I hope my photographs illustrate that this happens even in space."
That comment just seeds to my heart. I think that human beings, ever since they were able to make a handprint on the ceiling of a cave, have been advancing art forms ever since that time.
Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't realize that astronauts actually get photo training as part of their mission training.
We do. We have a very astute group of folks that train us to use these cameras. And these are not simple cameras to use. These are fully professional cameras with lots of push buttons and controls. And you need to know at least how about 20% of them work. And mostly for being able to take these prosaic engineering photos that document how the machinery is working on space station.
Now, you set up a very elaborate photography platform on the space station. Tell us what you did there.
Okay, this is called a barn door tracker by amateur astronomers, which is basically a piano hinge fastening two pieces of plywood together and a bolt that can hinge them apart. And you put a camera on that and line it up right, and you turn the bolt maybe a quarter of a turn every 10 seconds, and it will counteract Earth's motion. So the camera mounted to the board will track the stars, and you can take beautiful pictures of star fields from Earth. And I basically built a similar apparatus on space station so that I could be in space counteracting orbital motion to take pictures of Earth.
Is there a little motor that turns that for you?
Instead of just turning the bolt by hand, I hooked it up to our battery-powered drill driver. And then I had a little telescope fastened onto the platform that I looked through. And when the images of cities at night were stationary in the telephoto lens, then I would snap pictures through a cable release with a camera that was also mounted on the platform.
Now, a lot of astronauts, almost all the astronauts, are busy taking pictures. How do you, as a photographer, make your work stand out?
You have an amazing subject in which to take pictures of the Earth and the vicinity around Earth. It's almost a no-brainer. If you can make the exposure correct and you get in focus, you're going to have a picture which will appeal to folks on Earth. And then it's just a question of making a photograph composition so that you find it appealing. And it's more on what you leave out, I believe, than what you put in.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have the distinction, as I said before, of having taken the 1,000,000th photo from the space station. Do you remember what that was?
I do, and I think I pass it on to you folks so you could put it on your website. But I want to point out that in the first 12 years of space station, all the crews put together had taken 500,000 pictures. And then on my last mission, the six of us total took another 500,000 pictures. So that pushed it up to the 1,000,000 mark, and that was July of 2012. And since then, we've just passed the 3,000,000 mark.
Wow, that's a lot of photos. And then, as Don has said, if you want to see the photos, they're up there on our website at sciencefriday.com/space photos. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Andrew in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Hi, Andrew.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
I just want to say, I think Google Maps satellite view was the greatest thing ever invented. But seeing pictures actually taken from space, there's just a difference, a verity to it. And my favorite photo ever was a volcano erupting on the Kamchatka Peninsula. I'm actually wondering if you ever got a chance to take a picture of a volcano while you were up there.
Yes, and there are volcanoes popping off practically any place on Earth at any one time. And so there's a volcano in Sicily, Etna, that seems to erupt every few weeks. And then there are volcanoes, active volcanoes, in the Patagonia region of Argentina and Chile. And then there are volcanoes in the Ring of Fire along the Pacific Rim, which was the one that you saw out of Kamchatka.
Do you have a favorite area of Earth that you like to photograph?
Probably the favorite area of every astronaut happens to be the Caribbean, because the broad expanse of turquoise water is just totally amazing from orbit.
Mm-hmm. Well, while you're taking photos, what are the other astronauts doing in their off-duty time?
Well, there are a number of sort of orbital scrimshaw activities that you do on orbit, because We work really hard. We work 12 to 14 hour days, and you do that for 6 months in a row, and you need something to do for relaxation when you aren't on duty. And it can vary from basket weaving to quilting to watching sports programs that are uplinked, taking pictures out the windows with a photography equipment is another favorite pastime. And then just doing little educational demonstrations on your own to show what an amazing environment this is and to get students fired up about math and science and engineering.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones to Joe in Oklahoma. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Hi there.
I love your show. I'm a biology major, and I also have a hobby in photography. Also from Oklahoma is a National Geographic photographer, Joel Sator. And I've met him a few times, and back in the day, he would go through 100 to 200 rolls of film. And back then, it was maybe the best you could get was 18 megapixels. And he said, you need at least 25 to match film. So my question is, does he prefer film or digital?
Okay. I started off with film, and I was reluctant to switch to digital. And now that I've switched to digital, I prefer the digital. The dynamic range on digital photography is greater than film. And with the megapixel densities we have on our detectors, we're rivaling the resolution limit of what the lenses can offer. So then the instant satisfaction of being able to look at your picture and make changes and not have to wait a day or two.
Mm-hmm.
So I really like the digital expansion into photography.
Now, I understand you got to attend a talk by Ansel Adams when you were at the University of Arizona, and he is very well known for his black and white photos. Did that influence you at all?
It has. At that point, I was mostly taking black and white photos. I was in graduate school, and still affording color film was a little beyond my budget, and I could shoot black and white and develop myself and do it on the cheap. And listening to somebody whose medium was also black and white was fascinating. And listening to the detail that he paid attention to at the time of composition and when he took the picture, I found amazing.
The book you put out has a foreword by Alan Bean, who's a painter now. Other astronauts have also taken up artistic pursuits. Nicole Stott retired from NASA to paint full-time. Chris Hadfield has an album. What is the link between spaceflight and the arts?
I think it is a means. Art can be a means to share the experience. And photography is one medium. The music and painting are other mediums. We as space explorers have this amazing opportunity to go someplace that most people on the planet can't go to right now. And I believe we have an obligation to share that experience with everybody that's still on the planet. And you realize that it's the people on the planet that are paying for the hardware in which we ride on to get into space. So it comes with an obligation to share the experience with those that make it all possible.
You're still an active astronaut. Are you looking forward someday to going back?
I am an active astronaut. I keep all my training up to date, and I'm in the pool of people from which flight assignments are made, and I'm really hoping I get another flight assignment, and time will tell whether that happens.
Let me see if I can get another phone call. Let's go to Northern Virginia. Matt, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thanks for having me. So I have a question. You're talking a lot about merging the arts and sciences and kind of giving that really surreal almost experience for folks on Earth. A lot of people talk about astronauts experiencing what's called, described as the over-Earth effect, where astronauts and people looking down on Earth experience super consciousness or realization of a self above themselves. I'm wondering if you have any experience with that, or if it's talk with others you have, and what your thoughts are on that.
Mm-hmm.
What I could say about looking at Earth from space is that it reaffirms what your pre-existing views are. That's been my experience. And some of my poetry shows, I guess, what is going on inside of my brain when I look at the planet from space. And it's hard to describe with words in a normal kind of essay.
Can you read a little bit of your poetry for us?
I can, and this poem's called Last Day in Space, and I'll read a few lines so that we can leave room for other folks to call in. It's kind of a long poem. Here we go. Tomorrow we light our rocket. We burn our engines and likewise burn a hole in the sky and fall to Earth. How does one spend your last day? Looking at Earth? A blue jewel surrounded by inky blackness. Occipital ecstasy. Unconstrained by your girth, you fly with vestigial wings. The atmosphere on edge, an iridescent blue with no earthly parallel, electrifying, diaphanous beauty, guarded by sirens of space, singing saccharine songs, beckoning you to crash on the Atmos reef, which tears you limb for limb and scorching what remains into cosmic croutons that sprinkle onto the garden salad of Earth. And maybe for a cliffhanger, Ira, I should stop right there.
That was beautiful. Do you have a collection we can read more of?
I've got a lot of poetry, which is something that I primarily write for myself because I like to read it back on occasion. And I've been kind of reluctant to bring it out in the open because it does expose your personal feelings to the rest of the world and you know what that will bring. But I do have a lot of poetry, and yeah, and eventually I'll be sharing it with folks.
That's great. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International, talking with a poet and astronaut, Don Pettit. Before we go, I have to ask you, we were all saddened to hear about the passing of astronaut John Glenn yesterday. Did you ever get a chance to meet him?
I have on several occasions, particularly when he went back in training for around 1998 for his second flight at age 77. And he was at the Johnson Space Center. He was flying the T-38. He was in Building 9, where he have all the mock-ups doing simulations. He was in Building 5, where he have the motion-based sims for asset and entry on the space shuttle. And we got to see him around the office. He'd come to pick up his mail, just like all the other normal astronauts do. It was really neat to see a hero of mine just operating like all us other garden variety astronauts do.
Yeah, he put his pants one leg at a time on. Same. We had a chance to meet him in the early days of Science Friday. We were on Capitol Hill, and he made a comment with us on Capitol Hill. He had a dirty snowball, and he was very, very proud to help, you know, promote science, talk about science whenever he could.
Well, the whole foundation that allows us to travel into space to make the machines relies on math and science and engineering. And if you don't understand that, and if you don't have people that can work in that field, you're not going to get off the planet.
Well, Don, speaking of getting off the planet, we wish you well in your quest to get back into orbit. So happy holidays, good luck with the book, and thank you again. It's just beautiful, beautiful photos in the book, and as I say, it's on our website, a sampling, sciencefriday.com/space photos. Thank you, Don Pettit.
It's been a pleasure, Ira.
Don Pettit, NASA astronaut, who is joining us from the Johnson Space Center in Houston. After the break, we're going to talk about a group of female astronomers in the early 20th century whose discoveries were a key to our current understanding of the universe. A new book, Glass Universe, We'll be right back with it after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When you look up at the sky at night, you've probably noticed that each star has its own brightness. You might even know that measuring that light can tell you how far away it is, the composition of that star, and even reveal clues about the expansion of the universe. But you may not know that our understanding of how to classify stars came from the work of a group of female astronomers, women who worked at the Harvard College Observatory 100 years ago. My next guest is the author of a new book that recounts the stories and discoveries of those scientists. Davis Sobel is author of The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measures of the Stars. And she joins me in our CUNY studios. Welcome back. Always good to see you.
Thank you. Fun to be here with you.
And let our listeners know that we have an excerpt from the book on our website at sciencefriday.com/universe. Now, David, you've written Women in Astronomy before, Galileo's Daughter. How did you come across this group of female astronomers?
I first learned about them from astronomer Wendy Friedman. I was interviewing her, must have been more than 20 years ago, and she mentioned the name Henrietta Leavitt, which I had never heard. And then when I went to look up more about Miss Leavitt, I discovered she was in a room full of women at Harvard, which was a big surprise. One doesn't think of lots of women getting to do astronomy at Harvard.
You know, we're hearing so many more stories about women scientists, engineers that we never heard of.
I know. Before. It's their moment.
It is their moment. When this group started out, they were working even before women had the right to vote.
That's right.
That's how long ago that was.
That's right. 1870s, 1880s. It's really exciting stuff.
So what was it like to be a woman and amongst male scientists, to be a female scientist who's doing research?
I think it was fine. They were very well treated. They got credit for their work all the time. They knew they were doing something unusual, that they'd been given a remarkable opportunity, and they ran with it.
And what was their main job? What were they supposed to be doing?
The main job in this book is the analysis of photographs on glass plates. So this was a new thing in astronomy, to be able to take long exposure photographs and discover things that couldn't be seen even through the most powerful telescopes. So they were actually making discoveries, and they were trying to figure out how much they could learn from starlight about the content of the stars, their evolutionary history, their distances. At the beginning of the story, almost nothing was known about what stars were made of, how they created their heat and light. And by the end, just about everything was known.
And looking at the photographs, basically they slaved over these glass plates. Describe what they were doing.
Yes, well, they're large plates. Some of them are 8 by 10, some are 11 by 17. And there are thousands of stars on them. Thousands.
Appearing as black little dots.
Little black dots. Or for some pictures, the light got passed through a prism. And then instead of a dot, there'd be a little strip, little smear of a strip for each star with shades of black, white, and gray and dark lines. And from those patterns, they created a classification system for the stars that is still in use.
So they had to decide how bright the star was, how far away it was, it might be.
When they were looking at the spectra, they were really looking at the pattern of the lines, mm-hmm. and trying to figure out which patterns made a logical category. And people needed those different categories to be able to get a taxonomy of the stars.
So they were basically cataloging all of these stars.
Yes, yes, cataloging, categorizing. Then there were also studies about brightness. Constitution. People wanted to know what elements were in the stars. And towards the end of the story, when the women in the observatory were not just working there, but doing graduate level research, the great abundance of hydrogen in the stars came to light for the first time.
Hmm. Edward Pickering, as you talk about, was the director of the observatory and the first person to start hiring the women. Why did he hire women?
He found some women there when he got there,
yeah,
because the resident astronomers' wives, daughters, sisters had already been put to work. So there was a precedent. But then in his time, women began to be hired from outside, women who didn't have any particular background in astronomy, but they were good at math and they could do calculations, and they were welcome. They also cost less to hire. An evergreen theme. Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, one of the first members of the team, Wilhelmina Fleming, started out as Pickering's maid.
Yes,
right?
Yes. Yeah, she was in desperate straits because she'd been married. Now she was pregnant, and her husband had disappeared on her. So she took the job as a maid. But he noticed how bright she was and moved her over to the observatory and taught her how to do the work there.
And now, as you point out, the hiring of the women was important, but the funders themselves were also women.
Yeah, the big project for classifying the stars was completely funded by a very wealthy New Yorker named Anna Palmer Draper. And she had worked with her husband on a project that they were hoping to devote their lives to. And then he died suddenly at age 45. And she, out of love for him, to create a memorial, she gave the money to Harvard to carry on his work. And the money she gave was beyond their entire annual operating budget every year.
Wow. Cecilia Payne Gaposchkin, is that her name?
Yes.
She was one of the late members of the team, and we have a clip from an interview recorded in 1968 by the famous Owen Gingerich, who was a great historian of science, from the Niels Bohr Library and Archives at the American Institute of Physics. And here she describes leaving Cambridge for Radcliffe College, which was the female annex of Harvard.
The whole thing was pretty intoxicating. And also being free for the first time to do astronomy just as much as I wanted when I never had been before was intoxicating, because even though I'd done these little bits of research at Cambridge, lights had to go out at 11 and the Radcliffe building where I worked didn't even mind if I was out all night working. For a bit, I almost worked night and day without stopping. It was marvelous.
So she earned the first PhD in astronomy at Harvard. And that came about as a result of all the earlier women, because another heiress gave money for fellowships for young women to come and work at the observatory for a year and then go on for full-time employment somewhere else. And so when the new director who replaced Pickering after his death, Harlow Shapley, started a graduate education program in astronomy, the only fellowship money he had, was these fellowships for women. So all the early graduate students were women.
And so these women who might have remained maids or, you know, in the former jobs were given a way up.
But by that time, there were many more women coming in who'd had a college education and had experience on the telescope. Even by 1896, when Annie Jump Cannon came to the observatory, she was allowed to make her own observations.
You know, it struck me that the title, Glass Universe, is also the glass ceiling.
Indeed.
Was that on?
It was very intentional, yes.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah. But the glass universe is the plate collection.
Yeah. Very nice play on words.
Thanks.
There. Talking with David Sobel, who is author of The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. And how important was their work to what we're seeing today in astronomy?
Well, the classification system is still used. It led to the understanding that the different categories really signified different temperatures. At the beginning, it wasn't known what they signified. They just looked different. Now we know they're different stellar temperatures because stars have different lifestyles. Mm-hmm. And they also help show the life stage of the star. And another study, which was not really related to the classification, but the work done by Henrietta Leavitt, which Wendy Friedman first mentioned, has to do with being able to tell relative distances in space. And that first led to an understanding of how far away from us the satellite galaxies of the Milky Way that you can see from the Southern Hemisphere. She was looking at pictures of those, and her discovery helped establish how far they were, and then how big the Milky Way was. And then Edwin Hubble used her discovery to show that the Milky Way was only one galaxy among many, and later used it again to show that the universe was expanding. So it was pretty important.
Yeah. How many Nobel Prizes, you know, were these women?
Well, unfortunately. Somebody wanted to give Miss Leavitt the Nobel Prize, but she'd already died. And you can't win it posthumously. So she missed out.
You know, we talked to Margaret Lee Shetterly, who wrote Hidden Figures about the African-American human computers at NASA. Mm-hmm. Do you think there are, and these are also these women who are spoken of as computers, too,
yes,
right?
Yes, these were the great-granddaughters of the Harvard ladies.
And do you think that there are other teams of human computers doing other things that we haven't discovered yet, perhaps, coming out now? Or?
I don't know. After the Rocket Girls and the Langley women, I don't. I think we've tapped all the computers. But if I'm wrong, I'll be happy to to learn more.
And David Sobel is author of The Glass Universe: How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measures of the Stars. And you can read an excerpt of her book at sciencefriday.com/universe. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Bonnie in Northern Virginia. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, Ira.
Hi there.
So I'm an earth. Well, I've taught earth science for about 14 years, and now I'm teaching middle school science. And when I was teaching earth science and showing the kids how to do the HR diagram and all that, I always would, you know, let them know about Annie Cannon and how she had a big role to play in that, but she did not get much credit. And so I'm just wondering now, with, you know, with this research that's showing, you know, how much women were actually involved in this stuff, you know, when are we going to start getting, you know, being able to give them credit? Like, when are the textbooks going to catch up, and when are people going to start knowing Annie Cannon and some of these other ladies by name, the way that we know Niels Bohr and other scientists who were all men?
Maybe now. But just to make you happy, or I hope it'll make you happy, she really did get credit in her own lifetime. And she was awarded the Draper Medal from the National Academy of Sciences, which was a huge honor. So during their lifetimes, the women definitely felt appreciated, and all their discoveries were credited to them in their publications.
Thank you for calling, Bonnie. Good luck with your kids. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with author David Sobel, who's author of The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. She brought up an interesting point about women scientists and getting the recognition that they deserve. Is that an issue, do you find? You've spoken to a lot of women scientists. It's still an issue with them?
Well, they still feel it's a problem to get the high-level positions. I don't think getting recognition for work done is a problem.
Yeah.
But I think generally now there is so much anti-science bias that the more we can tell true stories about science, we'd better get them out there.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. You know, I was asked to put a panel together of women scientists.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to four physicists I know, women scientists, and I asked each one of them, would you want to sit on a panel of women scientists? And all four of them said no. We don't want to be known anymore.
They don't want to be identified as women scientists.
Right.
One of the women at Harvard today was given a chance to be considered for the Annie Jump Cannon Prize, which is still awarded every year. And she refused because she didn't want any prize that was just for a woman. So there's that issue, too. It's complex.
Yeah, they want to be known as just women who do science,
exactly.
Like men. Like
exactly.
Men who do science don't want to be categorized that way.
Right.
Well, how did the women get along together? I mean, here you have all these strangers,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, no, they got along very well. They had to work in pairs because when one was looking at a plate, she would have to say aloud what she was seeing there. It would waste too much time to be looking up and back. So they had teams. And then they all pitched in on big projects, especially the publications. Those publications have page upon page of numbers and columns, and everything had to be carefully proofread. So groups worked together on that. And then they all socialized together.
Is that right?
Saturday night, they get together and play games and make music. It was a very collegial group.
It was a close-knit organization.
Yes, and the observatory was a center not only for the people who worked there, but visiting scientists from other observatories and from Europe. Some people came from Europe and spent months or years there because of the plate collection.
And then they finally combined the two observatories, Harvard and Smithsonian.
And Smithsonian, yes.
What is that, 1970-something?
Today it's the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics.
Great place.
Yeah.
Great place. You visit it often?
Often. It was my second home for a few years, and happily so.
We can see from the book a lot of work, a lot of research went into this book.
But I enjoy that.
Yeah.
People who complain they slaved in dusty archives, I don't buy it. Nobody makes you do it. It's really fun.
Well, we can tell you had fun and enjoyed it from how well the book turned out, Deva.
Thank you for writing it.
Deva Sobel, author of The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measures of the Stars. She's with me in our CUNY studios, and you can read an excerpt from the book at our website at sciencefriday.com/universe. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. If you want to write us the old classic way, yeah, we still get stuff through that little slot in the door. Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. Or you can email us the new way, scifry@sciencefriday.com. Also, hey, we're up all week on Facebook and Twitter and on our website at sciencefriday.com. Where we have, we're looking for teachers. If you're a teacher, we have a new outreach program on our website at sciencefriday.com. We want to hear from you, and we want you to have a great weekend because we're going to see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.